The question for this hour might be, in today's political and legal climate, can freedom of expression survive? I say that ironically because one of our guests, an academic entrepreneur, has trademarked the phrase freedom of expression and could probably file an injunction against me right now. But he may not be able to call himself an entrepreneur because someone else has trademarked that term. I want to be fair and balanced about this, but Fox News has that one trademarked. It seems that our language is being privatized. Another question. Since the internet enables the global distribution of music, text, art, and other creative works, shouldn't we be entering a golden age of cultural exchange and artistic freedom? The problem there is if you borrow an idea from somewhere, or let's say sample a few musical notes, Deep Pockets might take you to court. If you share music through the internet, you might be sued. And even if it would be an instance of fair use, what we call fair use, we run into barriers like copy protection that disables the enabling technology. Our guests today are two scholars who have researched and written widely on the clash between free expression and control of information in the digital age. Kimber McLeod is a professor of communication studies at the University of Iowa, and he's the proud owner of the phrase freedom of expression. Professor McLeod is also the author of the book Owning Culture, Authorship, Ownership, and Intellectual Property Law, and a forthcoming book entitled Freedom of Expression, Overzealous Copyright Bozos and Other Enemies of Creativity. He's also written music reviews for Rolling Stone and The Village Voice, among other things, and has authored some pretty interesting pranks in his time. Siva Vaidyanathan is director of the undergraduate program in communication studies in the Department of Culture and Communication at New York University. He's also the author of the book Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity, and a new book just published entitled The Anarchist in the Library, How the Clash Between Freedom and Control is Hacking the Real World and Crashing the System. We'll talk with them during this hour. They are here to take part in a international conference called the Crossroads Conference here at the University of Illinois. And we'll talk with them during this hour about some of these ideas, and maybe we'll trade some MP3 files. What the heck? Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I also want to invite listeners to join the conversation. If you have thoughts, questions, comments on the topic, all you have to do is give us a call. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, do you want to say something about the conference to start out with?
Well, the conference is a all-weekend global unification of a variety of scholars who approach culture from a variety of orientations. So it's going to be a very fascinating conference. And the University of Illinois has been the center of cultural studies in North America for a couple decades now. So it's very exciting to be here, and it's especially exciting to be on WILL. I've had the pleasure of doing a couple of shows with you in the past, and I have to say to everybody who has the ability to listen to this station, it is one of the finest radio stations in the country, and you should definitely not take its quality for granted.
That's why you should contribute.
Well, thanks. I couldn't have put it better myself. Well, let's dive into to some of the stuff. I want to focus to some extent on Siva, your new book, The Anarchist in the Library. It's really an outstanding book, and it deals with some issues that I think we're all just really having a hard time resolving. You sort of note that in many ways, culture has always been a sort of peer-to-peer kind of architecture, that is, people relate one-to-one instead of in a hierarchy, and that the internet in many ways just simply enlarges this ability of people to communicate with each other. It's sort of a peer-to-peer world made larger and faster. But this is also now clashing with the desire to control all the stuff going through the wires, and maybe, you know, sort of a redefinition of what information is all about. It's now information has become property.
Right, right. And, you know, that's what's really dangerous. And that's the danger that both Kembrew and I identified a number of years ago. And we're both, I think, thrilled and a little bit alarmed that the issue has grown to such levels of importance. We both were in graduate school in the 1990s, worried about trends that we saw affecting music, creativity, literature, and we saw how the law was likely to shift under our feet. we had no idea that they would reach the absurd extremes that they have today. So my book and Kembrew's books come out of the fact that we're both basically punk rockers who saw how the most exciting forms of creativity spread through communities, spread anarchistically, spread rhizomatically, by friends sharing things with friends, whether that was cassette tapes or mimeographed zines. And so when we saw those same behaviors mimicked, amplified on the internet, to us it seemed like something to celebrate.
And around the same time, after talking to each other, we realized we became interested in the topic around the same time, around the early 90s, 91. And the watershed moment for me was when this anarchistic sound collage group from the Bay Area, Negative Land, was sued by U2 and Island, its label, Island Records. And I had been listening to Negative Land, and they're incidentally on a punk rock label named SST, so they shared the same bill with Black Flag and others. And so it just seemed like a very interesting creative project, and I'd been listening to them in high school. And I'd never once thought about copyright, or I may have, but not the way I think about it now. And it wasn't until that lawsuit happened in 1991 that really motivated me. And it wasn't until years later that I was able to really articulate to myself why that basically created and blazed that path, that intellectual path that I followed for the past like 13 some odd years.
Sure.
And it's because there was a real clash between creativity and freedom of expression, and kind of what I saw at the time as a very arbitrary way to apply the law. Also, incidentally, I just recently found out from Negative Land member Mark Hosler, the person who sent – do you know who sent the their record to U2's manager, Siva?
No, I don't.
It was REM's manager.
That
was bought in Athens, Georgia.
I mean, we each gathered a bunch of anecdotes throughout our early days being curious about this, in which artists, the people who were supposed to benefit most from copyright, were finding their works threatened, their livelihood threatened, because they were doing what everybody from Shakespeare to T.S. Eliot to Bob Dylan had been doing, which is building on the works of others. It just so happened that the tools they had at their disposal raised all sorts of red flags to people who were either technophobic or ethnocentric. So and Kembrew and I got to be buddies through this research in copyright. We found that, of course, we had grown up at the same time listening to the same bands, whether that was Public Enemy or Black Flag, and we sensed that there was a spirit that created the coolest stuff in the world, and that spirit was threatened. So now we've immersed ourselves in this from a scholarly point of view, which gives us two challenges. One is to make sense of the movement in the most sophisticated, high-minded way, but the other is to get the word out. Because one of the things we found is that 5 years ago, we were among the very few people raising concerns about these issues, and nobody was really interested. Eyes would glass over whenever you talked about copyright. We had publishers saying no one would care about this stuff.
Yeah, and in 1993, I went to grad school at University of Virginia, and I told a professor my interest in copyright and culture, and I can still remember him saying, copyright, why would anyone be interested in that?
Right.
But go ahead.
And now it's, front page of the New York Times every couple of weeks. I mean, it's an amazing thing, because now we realize that there's not only money at stake, but there's culture and freedom at stake. And in a global connected world, there is nothing more serious than the limitations we put on the ability of people to contact each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about the relevance of copyright and the passion that people feel over some of these issues. If you talk to librarians, certainly, I mean, maybe one doesn't associate passion with librarians, but this is something that they are really up in arms about.
Yeah. Well, they're passionate when you mess with their business, right? I mean, that's the amazing thing about librarians is they know more than any other members of our society what's at stake and what's at risk when you start messing with the flows of information. They have sworn an oath to the ethic of openness. it seems that both corporate and government influences now have undermined that ethic. And so they've been on the front lines. They've been on the front lines as long as we have, and they're some of our greatest allies in these things.
Yeah, and another thing that should point out and something we'll probably return to later is a lot of these business interests who are trying to restrict these open flows of information don't realize that openness and making money are things that are diametrically opposed. I mean, just take the example of the VCR. In the 1970s, these proto VCR companies and companies that sought to, for instance, want to rent videos of Disney movies would approach Disney, and Disney executives would say, and you know, this is pretty much a direct quote, "How would we know how many people are in the living room watching it, and and how many times could they see it?" And what they didn't realize is that, well, having kids sit in front of the TV and watch Disney films, Little Mermaid, et cetera, over and over and over again creates tremendous revenue flows. So it's not like we're – I mean
– Well, that's one thing we can add to this, because one of the things we understand about culture, which we wish Hollywood understood about culture, is that culture is not zero sum. Right, the fact that somebody is able to tap into a cultural product or scene or flow for no marginal cost doesn't mean there's no money at the end for somebody. Somebody's always making money in there. It may be your high-speed modem, provider. Mm-hmm. It may be, which is usually Time Warner or AT&T anyway. But it may be somebody down the line who produces the next version of what you're messing with. But culture builds itself that way, and the culture industries therefore demand a very very light level of intervention from the state. Unfortunately, these days we're getting a pretty heavy level of it.
Yeah, I mean, if we followed what the entertainment industry wanted in terms of what it thought was best for it, we wouldn't have the iPod, for instance, because in 1999 the RIAA took Rox. I can't remember which company at the time it was to court.
Rio.
I wanted to say Roxio. And for that matter, we'd still be stuck with sheet music.
Right. In fact, the only reason that we have VCRs in our living room is that there was a 5-4 Supreme Court decision mm-hmm. in 1984. Mm-hmm. I mean, that should really boggle the mind, right? Mm-hmm. That there was one Supreme Court justice vote away from not having VCRs in our lives. Incidentally, a couple days ago, Senator Orrin Hatch filed a bill that would reverse that Supreme Court decision and make companies that produce copying technologies liable for the copyright infringements that occur. That should really alarm us. And this is what's going on, is that people in the West Coast are talking to people in D.C. and riling them up about this supposed emergency because, oh my gosh, the kids have too much freedom. And what they're talking about is re-engineering our personal computers, making our MP3 players virtually illegal, they're worried about driving out some entrepreneurs who happen to be able to make money on this stuff, although it remains to be seen how much money they're making. So we're in this real weird panic mode right now about the future of these entertainment industries, and it seems to us that they don't really understand what they're doing.
And what I think, you know, scholars like Siva and I and the many other people who are probably smarter than me can bring to the table is perspective, both theoretical perspective and historical perspective, because all we have to do is just take a step back and take a deep breath and look at the history of the entertainment industry. And the history of the entertainment industry is one that it's grown every time more openness is allowed. I mean, right. Put simply, and we can, you know, provide plenty of examples. But right. Do you have?
I mean, they're going to be winners and losers, right? So mm-hmm. maybe today's winners are tomorrow's losers. But the fact is, the U.S. entertainment industry has nothing to complain about these days. They're doing really well despite leaks in the system. And if they want to adjust leaks in the system, there are more humane ways to do it than the methods they've been trying.
We have a call to talk with. Why don't we include them in a conversation? And let me just take a moment to reintroduce our guests. We're talking this morning about copyright, intellectual property, fair use, technology, a variety of issues with regard to the clash between open information and control of information. Our guests are Siva Vaidyanathan. He's professor of communication studies at New York University. Also, Kembru McLeod, professor of communication studies at University of Iowa, both here in town to attend the Crossroads Conference. We have a caller on a cell phone. Let's talk with them. Line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to make a few comments. First, I wanted to say that the two books written by, I'm sorry, but I can't pronounce your last name.
Siva. Just call me Siva.
Siva. great. And particularly, I read last week The Anarchist in the Library.
Oh, thank you.
And I want to recommend that book in particular for people who find reading Lawrence Lessig gets them really bogged down.
Oh, that's nice. Thanks.
It's just less accessible. So I really liked your book. The other comments I wanted to make were, one, I had a VCR before it was actually, before it was legal, or at least it wasn't determined that it was legal to use. And I want to mention that people who believe or don't believe in conspiracy theories need to be aware that in the entertainment industry, there is definitely a conspiracy going on. And I'll mention one specific example. If you buy a DVR recorder, which also has a personal video recorder like TiVo, and it also plays DVDs, you cannot make a copy onto your PVR using, it will not transfer digital surround sound. It will only transfer left-right
the basic
sound.
Stereo.
In other words, what they have done is they have intentionally sold, and I've checked all the brands of PVRs that are around, they have disabled it. There is no input for a digital audio signal.
And what's right. And what's interesting about that sort of engineering move is that those companies want to be able to dictate to us what our media scapes are going to be like, what our surrounding environments are going to be. But ever since the Walkman, we've grown very accustomed to making our own choices about what goes on our ears, what goes in our ears, and what fills our rooms. So there is a struggle going on about who will get to and how we will get to control all of these media flows.
And there's also, this happened with VCRs, because I had one of the first Macrovision strippers, excuse me, we call these video stabilizers now, and I would go into video stores and I would ask people, and they would actually refuse to discuss video stabilizers.
Right.
And there's so we don't just have the entertainment industry, we have the electronic industry, we have Microsoft, which obviously gets involved in all of this stuff. And
well, the electronic industry wins both sides, right? Because they're selling us CD burners and MP3 players, and at the same time, they're working with consortia of other electronics users and Hollywood to make sure that Hollywood gets what it wants. So the electronics industry is a very complicated role in this. The only thing I would add is that it's not really a conspiracy if it's they're so blatant about it, right? And I think that's what's really astounding is that they're so audacious.
Yeah, another thing I'd like to add, and this is something I'm often guilty of getting bogged down in the minutia of specifics of technology. And I guess what I'm trying to say is a listener out there might be thinking, well, who cares really? I mean, about whether or not you can transfer surround sound and it can only get the regular stereo once you dump it to DVD. But there's a bigger issue at stake, which is, well, returning to what Siva said earlier, in 1984, the VCR was only one Supreme Court vote away from being illegal. And at first, again, the same listener, hypothetical listener I'm talking about might think, well, big deal, you know, big boohoo, big loss to the Best Buys of the world. But the VCR has been an extraordinarily important device to enable a functioning democracy within a media age. Well, I mean, first of all, it's allowed film scholars, television scholars. It's created this tremendous resource for these scholars. But more importantly, there are organizations like the Media Education Foundation and more generally the media education movement, which is about teaching kids the vocabulary of the image and the sound. Because, yes, I mean, certain kids are like certainly not even traditionally literate, but what we're finding more and more is that they're not media literate, and that's what the media literacy movement is about. And without the VCR, it would have been impossible to build this movement because we wouldn't have had the tools to basically remix, excerpt, and comment upon these images that are put out by the media industries. And what's happening now is that as we're moving from the analog world, the media industries lost the battle in the analog world. They lost the VCR battle. They lost plenty of other battles. But what they're trying to do is, and hopefully not successfully, is win the battle in the digital world, because they're using the boogeyman of the specter of the internet and digital, just the digital age more general, as a way to justify these claims that have been unproven throughout history, that openness means the end of industry.
Right.
I just want to make two very quick comments. One is, just as a historical fact, not only should we talk about the entertainment field, but we should note that it was actually the high-energy physics community which set up its own archive so that pup papers didn't have to go through referees, journals. In fact, in the old days, there was a court ruling that said you had to put advertisement on the bottom of each page of an article published in a journal. And basically the physics community said, we don't need this. We can monitor ourselves. And we went ahead.
And that's an example of people really making a system of their own from the ground up to evade these gatekeepers.
And on an optimistic note, and I'll end with this, all I'll say is freedom wants – information wants to be free, and it doesn't matter what the industry tries to do. There are hackers, and we'll break through it. We always have, and we always will. And what industry has to do is to respond with a proper economic incentive for us to want to buy their product rather than to simply take it. That's their problem. They have to do that. And then basically, we don't photocopy books if the books are reasonably priced. But when a book starts to cost, and you know some of the publishers where the books are costing approximately 25 cents per page, then you go and you photocopy it. Once the industry realizes and gets the right economic model, we won't have problems, because I don't think people basically steal unless they feel they're getting ripped off. And that they also are basically lazy and would rather buy something than to go to a lot of trouble to rip it off.
Right, right. Thank you.
I would add that my book isn't that expensive, so there's really no reason to photocopy. But if you want to, feel free. I mean, you can libraries have it all over the country, and that's one of the beautiful things we can celebrate about books, is that you can read them at no marginal cost, because we've decided as a society to subsidize reading and writing, and we're all better off for it.
Yeah. The previous caller had a good point, which is, you know, the standard line, information wants to be free and it will be free and there will always be hackers. One thing I wanted to add to that is one of the shortcomings of this movement, confederation of people that we've allied ourselves with, is that some of us tend to speak really, really narrowly. So it's true that there are going to be hackers that will always break free. But what I think Siva's and my goal is to really democratize and open up access so that, you know, the people who can enjoy the benefits of open culture aren't just this elite of hackers.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think also, Siva, in your book, you deal with this last point of the caller quite extensively, this sort of effort on the part of the industry to protect by technical means or legal means or whatever means their ownership of their content in ways that people find frustrating and just ridiculous, and they, you know, and not effective either.
Yeah, yeah.
So what they do is they find ways to hack, you know, the DVD encoding, you know, copy protection algorithms that they put into place, because they're ridiculous. I think actually one of those is like 8 lines of code, you know, it's just absurd. So this obsessive attempt to control the content meets with not only frustration, but actually it sort of fosters a disrespect for the very effort to protect the content. So what it actually is counterproductive.
It is. And that's what we look at. I mean, look, 5 years ago, Congress passed this law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and it put legal teeth behind a technology that we call digital rights management, which basically means bottling up digital content in a particular medium so that only authorized players under certain conditions can tap into that stuff. The DVD is the best example. DVDs have digital rights management technology on them. Therefore, you can only play them in the players that say DVD on them, even though the technology is the same as every CD player. So with that in mind, The law says that if you distribute a technology that evades that protection, then you're definitely civilly liable. And if you sell that stuff, you're criminally liable. Okay, what happens with that? Well, a lot of people have some very good reasons to evade those technologies, either because there's technological failure. The technologies aren't so good and they actually prevent anybody accessing it. Librarians have run into those situations. Sometimes they're using those technologies to bottle stuff up that we all own, stuff in the public domain, public facts and so forth. Sometimes people want to take little slices of a piece of material and make fair use of it, but they can't because of the digital rights management. So what we have is 5 years down the line, since we've been living with this increased regime of digital rights management and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, where are we? We're in a situation where there is nothing you can't get on the internet and nothing you can't get on a street corner in Hong Kong, Shanghai, St. Petersburg, or New York City, right? Digital piracy has not been stopped one bit. The bad guys still get to do everything they wanted to do. The folks who are really suffering are researchers, artists, librarians, scholars, teachers, students. They're the ones who should be able to make legitimate use of this material. So we've created this situation where the good guys are getting punished and threatened and sued and sometimes jailed, and the bad guys are laughing, right? That's the worst possible way to do law and policy.
An example of how the Digital Millennium Copyright Act closes up and – or at least it discourages creativity and scholarship is – I was a producer for the Media Education Foundation, which – quick backstory is a foundation, a video production house, nonprofits that was set up by a professor named Sut Jolly. And it was actually set up after he had created a video that critiqued sexist imagery on MTV. And back in 1991, he got a cease and desist letter from MTV for copyright and trademark infringement. He set up originally the MEF as a way that if he were to be sued, he wouldn't be, you know, he wouldn't lose his house. It would. So anyway, thanks to MTV, for the past 12 years, the Media Education Foundation has produced about 100 videos that use imagery from mass media to critique mass media, et cetera. So it deals with issues of race and gender, nationalism. And the only way in which they can make – the Media Education Foundation can make these videos legally is because the United States 1976 copyright law has a provision that allows for fair use of copyrighted materials for a number of things, including educational purposes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what happened when in 1998 the Digital Millennium Copyright Act came along is that it essentially made fair use a moot point because if we want to – and for instance, I produced a documentary, Money for Nothing, Behind the Business of Popular Music for MEF back in 2000. And we had to crack a DVD in order to get a particular image. What we did was we broke the law. We broke the Digital Millennium Copyright Act because we bypassed that technology, the digital rights management, the barrier that is supposed to stop us from copying that material. Well, yes, it's fair use. That is, the end purpose is fair use. But in order to get to that point, we broke the law. And that's just an absurd situation.
Well, you've just admitted it on the radio, man.
I know.
Well, have you seen his website? I think he actually Cameron McLeod, I wanted to ask you to tell us the story about trademarking freedom of expression. I know you probably get asked that in every interview, but it's just such a great story.
Well, returning to Negative Land in 1991,
yeah, sure.
They were sued and I decided to write an undergrad paper about it. And I was in an office with my advisor and we were bantering and we came up with the idea of trademarking freedom of speech or expression. Well, it's $240 to trademark something and I was an undergrad and then a poor grad student, just didn't have the money as opposed to, you know, Fox News or whomever else who can – $240 is just a drop in the bucket and they can basically gobble up as many parts of our language as they want. So I finally saved up the money and in 1998, incidentally, which is the same year that Fox News was awarded Fair and Balanced as a trademark, which they later sued Al Franken and his publisher for
That's
using in the
story.
Title of his book.
Right.
And fortunately, Al Franken's publisher didn't back down and prevailed in court. But anyway, back in 1991, had this idea and fooled around with it, finally was awarded in 1998 the trademark. And I knew if I sent out like a press release saying, you know, graduate student at University of Massachusetts is concerned about the intersections of culture, power, intellectual property law, blah, 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 they would, you know, right. It would just be ignored. So I got a friend, an old punk rocker friend, in fact, Brendan Love, to pose as a fictitious publisher of a zine, a punk rock zine called Freedom of Expression. And I hired a lawyer to send him a cease and desist letter. And I remember before going into the lawyer's office, a friend said, oh, she'll just laugh you out of the office. But, you know, I went in there with my documentation and it was a very clear-cut case. So, you know, it got some regional media attention, and then that snowballed and some, like, London Guardian picked it up and other places. So later, I guess a year ago, when AT&T used freedom of expression as the slogan for an ad, it printed an ad in the local newspaper, the Daily Iowan. I did the same thing. I hired a lawyer and sent a cease and desist letter. And at that time, it's got much more play. And the point of it is, the point of doing these media pranks, first of all, is to inject a little bit of humor into a movement that can sometimes, again, as I said, get bogged down in technological details, and it can be humorless. But more importantly, it's also a critique of the media. It's, you know, I knew I was playing their game. I knew that if I had a very kind of simplistic hook that was easy for reporters to wrap their head around and create a nice lead, they would jump on it. But so that allows me to perhaps get a few more lines in the article where I might be able to engage in a little bit more sophisticated critique. But overall, it's just an attempt to get some attention around a particular kind of critique that typically doesn't get as much play in mainstream media.
And, you know, Kember's prank has been immensely effective. It's retold by people who encounter absurd situations like that. Mm-hmm. Right now, yeah. The state of Texas, right, the Texas Highway Department is trying to frighten people away from producing bumper stickers and T-shirts that say, don't mess with Texas, right? Because don't mess with Texas has been their anti-litter campaign slogan for about 20 years. Really successful anti-litter campaign. But of course, the phrase has entered the public mind, right? It is part of being Texan now. Mm-hmm. So now they're worried because – you know, people are saying don't mess with Texas and using don't mess with Texas for their own purposes and not about litter. So, they're, you know, the people in the state office who are supposed to be working for the people of the state of Texas are now behaving as if they're private enterprise. And this sort of bleed over between public and private interest is something we're concerned about. And every time that people bring up one of these absurd situations, somebody says, I remember that guy who trademarked freedom of expression. Remember that? That was a great joke. That was a great prank. Mm-hmm. And these sorts of nuggets stick in the public mind and really bring things out in the open. Because if you just talk about it at the surface and you get swept along in this maelstrom of privatization talk, you don't actually realize how stupid it all seems. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So every once in a while, you need somebody like Kember to come and shake everybody up.
Yeah, well, I heard Al Franken discussing his little court episode with Fox News taking him to court over his use of the phrase fair and balanced in his book cover. And the way he described it, you know how people say, well, it got laughed out of court, you know, as a sort of expression. Well, in his case, it really did get laughed out of court. The judge just completely laughed it out.
Yes.
And dismissed the case, you know, on his face. But the problem is, okay, his publisher had lots of money to mm-hmm. fight that,
exactly.
Whereas most people wouldn't be able to do that.
Exactly. You know, Kember had a lot of knowledge, so he could mess with that and do that prank. He had more knowledge than he had $240, right? That's why it took him so long. Al Franken has a big publisher. You can talk about times when people are able to exploit the loopholes in these laws for the sake of freedom of expression. I'm sorry. when and if they work for big companies, right? So Hollywood itself exploits fair use whenever they can, and they exploit the public domain as much as they can, and they do a great job at it because they have the lawyers who can play both sides. But everyday people don't. The kid in his garage with a MIDI synthesizer doesn't. The guy with Pro Tools who's making some amazing collage is not in that sort of situation. The daycare center that wants to put Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse up on the wall and gets a cease and desist letter from Disney, they don't have the wherewithal or the high-priced lawyers to make a stand on that sort of thing. So we've been very busy trying to get the word out that the American people have to be really sick and tired of this creeping excess. And I think we're actually getting there. I think we have a movement going now that we didn't have 5 years ago. And it's a sort of distributed movement. It involves artists, it involves pranksters,
librarians,
teachers, people in religious communities who are all sick and tired of these excesses, and they're just starting to meet up with each other, and they're using the internet to meet up with each other. And you could call it a free culture movement. You could call it, I don't know, there are a bunch of different phrases floating around for it. But basically, Congress pretty soon is going to start to realize that they've gone too far by doing everything that Hollywood wants at the expense of the American people.
And there are examples of the quote-unquote little people who have been able to successfully stand up and use the fair use defense or even just invoke it and as kind of a barrier that's makes overzealous copyright bozos shy away. One example is Carrie McLaren, who's a publisher of a great little zine called Stay Free in New York. And she's a high school teacher in Brooklyn. And she does this magazine. I don't think it's ever turned a profit. I mean, she just does it out of love. That's the kind of the definition of a zine. Zine is short for magazine and it has its roots in punk rock communities in the 80s. But anyway, she mounted this thing called the Illegal Art Show, which was originally just one show that collected lots of works of art that had either been at the receiving end of a lawsuit or a cease and desist letter, or a work of art that had been taken down by a gallery because the gallery was just concerned that it could get a cease and desist. Mm-hmm. So the Negative Land album cover that the album cover of the record that had received the cease and desist letter is on display, along with lots of other great works like Tom Forsythe's Food Chain Barbie photograph series. He received a lawsuit. He was at the end of a lawsuit from Mattel, who said that they that he violated their trademarks. He eventually prevailed. He unfortunately spent about $200,000 in court out of his own pocket. And that's just with pro bono lawyers. That means lawyers who are willing to essentially donate their time for free. But the cost of getting expert witnesses and all sorts of other expenses pile up. But fortunately, Carrie McLaren, when she mounted this show, which eventually turned into a traveling art show, which hit Chicago, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and eventually SF MoMA in San Francisco, and also continues to have a web presence online, it never received a cease and desist letter because she kind of called their bluff in kind of a very politicized prank, if you will, in the Dada art tradition. She forced these intellectual property owners, overzealous copyright bozos, into a catch-22 where if they sued them, it would be really bad publicity for them. But if they tolerated its existence, it set a precedent that it created more elbow room for freedom of expression in the arts.
Right. And so Carrie McLaren is using the cultural power she has and the knowledge power she has because she doesn't have the bucks either. So you got to have basically two of those three things to be able to live as a full cultural citizen these days.
We just have about maybe 12 minutes left with our guests. So I want to take a moment, first of all, to pass along some news that I was asked to announce. GOP sources say Illinois Republican Jack Ryan plans to scrap his Senate campaign amid sex-related allegations. The sources who spoke on condition of anonymity say a formal announcement is expected within hours. So there's that. And also, to reintroduce our guests, we're talking for in the next few minutes. We have just about 12 minutes left, talking about copyright, intellectual property, and fair use with Siva Vaidyanathan, Professor of Communication Studies, New York University, and Kembru McLeod, Professor of Communication Studies, University of Iowa. And if you'd like to join us in the time remaining, the number again around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455.
Can I just say what a shame it is that something so petty would drive someone out of public life? I mean, didn't we just go through that like 5 years ago where something that is part of someone's private life nearly destroyed an agenda that might have made a difference in public life?
Yeah.
I mean, hey, I'm the biggest Obama fan in the world, but this guy had something go on between him and his wife and it's none of our business. And the Republicans have really sowed a really ugly garden here.
Yeah, I'm tempted to go into that tangent, but it's a long one.
Well, hey, I'm in Illinois on the radio. I'm going to take my shot.
All right. Well, thanks for that. But what I really wanted to ask in the time remaining to talk about, what is this thing we call culture? Because I think, and actually there's a phrase that you have in your book, Siva, the Anarchist in the Library. I'm going to probably not be as articulate as you, but it has to do with culture is not necessarily the products of art and literature and the things that we see on the shelves. It's everything that went before that.
Right. Culture is sharing. Right. Culture happens in a circle. It's what happens when people connect with language or with sight or sound or taste. And culture only matters when you share it, right? Culture doesn't matter when you keep it locked up in your house or your garage or your museum, your private collection, your gated community. That's not culture. That's merely an object. But once you've let it out and you've let people make meaning with it, then it has real value. So the culture industries are in this sort of paradoxical situation. They want to create artificial scarcity so they can charge money for it, and who could blame them? At the same time, they have to recognize that their material is only good if people can mess with it, run it through their minds and their lives, and expose it to the light of day. And when that happens, something cultural occurs. That's really an important distinction.
Yeah, going back to the culture industries, I mean, take the example, just refer back to what Siva was talking about, Nike. Nike Corporation doesn't own any factories. It really just owns its office buildings, pays its staff, but its value, economic value, lies in that swoosh, in the years and years of capital it's spent marketing itself. So Nike wants us to be very familiar with the swoosh. Nike wants us to be its friend, but it's a very obviously one-sided relationship. It's a very money-draining, selfish relationship. But the point is Nike, in order to be successful, has to saturate itself, its swoosh, it's the ideas that are connected to its swoosh throughout the culture. But that's as far as they want us to go. They don't want us to then talk back to it. They don't want us to as soon as we take that swoosh and, replicate it in a critical context, that's when the cease and desist letter comes or the lawsuit.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. A listener in Indiana, line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning. If there is, what's the limits of fair use? And if there isn't, what makes it not have limits?
Right. Well, the really frustrating and yet beautiful thing about fair use is there are no firm limits. It's a context-based question, and it's situation by situation. So, for instance, if you want to take a piece of a haiku, you can't take very much of it before you've taken the whole thing. And if someone sued you over it, your defense, and fair use is really only a defense in court,
right,
your defense would be, I only took what I needed to make commentary about it or make fun of it. But if you're talking about, my book, which is 250 pages, you could take a fair number of pages before a court would say, wait a minute, you've really infringed on this guy's copyright. Now, there are actually four factors that dominate fair use discussions. The first is the nature of the original work, whether it was nonfiction, which is supposed to flow freely in the community so we can have discussion and debate,
like
or
facts,
fiction.
Like a telephone book information.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. So a newspaper has a lower level of protection than a poem, essentially, or a song. The second is the way that you use the work, whether you are using it for profit or not. Thirdly is what's the third factor? The third is the amount of the work relative to the whole.
Yeah.
So you can't really take more than you really need to take to make your point. And the fourth is the effect on the potential market of the original work.
Right.
So if you're taking something, if you want to assign a chapter of my book in a classroom, and you took one chapter out of, I don't know how many chapters I even have.
11.
Okay, right. One chapter out of 11. Then you're probably going to fly below radar. If you start using, 12 of those, 10 of those chapters, then if I were to sue you, I would have a much better case.
And this is important. It's not like a yes-no checklist, where if you lose one of those categories, if one of those categories does not go in your favor, it's automatically not a fair use. So, you know, the most famous example is probably Two Live Crew Supreme Court case, where they essentially stole from Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman and created their own parody. And they had to, you know, parody by nature, you have to take a lot of the original because that's the nature of parody. But the Supreme Court ruled that even though it was for profit, that didn't rule it out as being a fair use. And also, another important category is that fourth category. Does the derivative work, does the work that does that second work that came along, does it usurp the firsts in the marketplace? So, and in that case, and in a lot of other cases, the answer is no. I mean, no one in their right mind is going to buy Two Live Crew's version of Pretty Woman as a substitute for Roy Orbison's.
Exactly. Now, but you know what's crazy about the fair use situation? What's useless about fair use is that you don't know the answer to your question: is it fair use? Until you've been sued and you hired a lawyer and you went to court. So thousands of dollars and months later, you might find out if what you did was fair use. So a lot of what goes on in the fair use world is hope and faith, right? We assume that what I do in the classroom when I show a movie on the screen is fair use. But we don't actually know unless I get sued by a movie studio for public performance. At that point, I have to go to court and defend myself. And if there's no precedent that speaks right to that issue, I might be in big trouble. I have to create precedent. That's the way the law works.
Yeah. So, I mean, what we find ourselves in the situation of typically three things. Freedom of expression is constrained when, well, obviously we get sued and we back down, or more importantly, our employers, because most of us work for people, whether they be universities or Time Warner. So number one, we find ourselves sued and we are, or our employers back down. Number two, we just receive a cease and desist letter, which is not the same as a lawsuit. It's just basically a bullying threat letter that's really cheap for legal departments at Disney to send out. And we back down. Number two, that's another example of how freedom of expression gets constrained. And then the other unfortunate, and this doesn't have to do with fair use, but another unfortunate situation is when laws like the Digital Millennium Copyright come along and actually do constrain the ways in which we can legally express ourselves.
We just have about 3 minutes left. I'm sorry, there's much more we'd like to talk about. But I guess I want to get back to this thing about what is culture and what has changed in our legal system and our attitudes about ownership of information that is so troubling. A century ago, people felt less constrained to share songs, ideas, lyrics, etc. What has happened in our law or our ideas about these things since that time that makes it so difficult?
In a nutshell, this neoliberal ideology of privatization, that it's actually good to put things in private hands because in private hands, culture or public land or whatever can be better maintained, which we see time and time again isn't true.
Yeah, and then combine that with the fact that the very industries that would argue for absurd levels of control happen to be richer than ever. They got richer than ever through the old system, right? The American film industry built itself by stealing scripts from novelists. The American printing industry built itself by stealing novels from England, right? So these are pirate industries. The software industry the same way. Microsoft never had a good idea in the entire history of that company. They've ridden along other people's ideas. So the loose parts of the copyright system, the holes in the copyright system, have built these great industries. Now they're turning around and saying, let's shut the door and not let anybody else develop and thrive.
I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop. We're at the end of our time. There's much more we could talk about, and I will suggest for folks, if you'd like to know more on this topic, certainly look for the book by The Last Voice, Siva Vaidyanathan, our guest, The Anarchist in the Library, How the Clash Between Freedom and Control is Hacking the Real World and Crashing the System, just published by Basic Books. Our other guest, Kimber McLeod, Professor of Communication Studies at University of Iowa. And you've got a book coming out in a few months?
Yeah, in February. It's called Freedom of Expression.
Okay. Well, we'll hopefully talk with both of you again in the future, and thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.